Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Us, I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
Buck Meek is a revelation. I spoke to him from about as far away as you can get and still be in the continental United States. I'm in the Northeast. He's in the Southwest, in Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles. I'm up here in the Hudson Valley. But I just immediately felt so familiar and easy with this guy I'd never met before. Big Thief, the band he's been in for years, is great. I love their music. He's got a new record, solo record, a Buck Meek record, that is about to drop called Two Saviors. And we talk a lot about that. He's kind of a heavy guy, kind of like a spiritual dude. I loved his repeated use of the word alchemical, alchemy, alchemized, because I think that word sounds like a good description of what he does musically. I feel so lucky to get to have these conversations under the auspices of Wheels Off. A lot of times I'm speaking with people I've known for years, but a lot of times I'm talking to people that I've never met before. Invariably, I'm nervous to speak to them. And every time I come away just reinvigorated by the generosity exhibited by most all people that live a creative life. Buck Meek does just that. He's done it his whole life. He's a seventh generation Texan, not unlike your boy here, me. He and I had a lot of fun talking. I had a lot of fun talking with him. I can't speak for Buck, but I really loved it, and I think you'll love listening to it. So thanks for joining me once again for Wheels Off, Buck Meek. Welcome to Wheels Off, Buck Meek. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
For the edification of our listeners, you are in Topanga Canyon in the Los Angeles area.
Yeah, I'm up in the Santa Monica Mountains.
Are you at home?
I'm at home. Yeah, I'm on my porch looking out over the bay trees.
I'm glad I can see where you are because I'm bummed because I'm so jealous. It is so beautiful there.
Thank you. Well, it looks like you have a pretty sweet room going wild over there with the red walls and all those guitars.
You know, it's funny. My kids made fun of me when I painted it red and hung up all my guitars because it's just this dumb little office in my garage. Sure. But then who's laughing now? During the pandemic, I do four shows a week from this room.
Nice. Red is so activating.
Yeah, they say it's a really creative color.
Yeah.
I guess it's been good. But yeah, thank you so much for joining me. This is so great. And I guess let me begin with my traditional first question. What creative project are you working on at the moment and how does it light you up?
Well, I just finished spending 4 months with Big Thief. Mm-hmm. Can't go into too much detail because it's a bit of a secret. But yeah, we were making a lot of new music together over the last 4 months around the country. We were in four different locations in the mountains of Colorado and out in Tucson, Arizona, in the Saguaro Park. and then up here in Topanga, and then we actually spent a little time in West Shokan in the Catskills, and yeah, making a lot of new music together.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's what studio were you in up here in the Catskills?
My friend Sam Owens has a studio called Flying Cloud. He and his partner Hannah Cohen. Yeah. And you may have heard, he has a project called Sam Evian that's killer. If you haven't heard Sam Evian, they're amazing.
Yeah, it's great. And I love Big Thief. I'm excited to hear there's new Big Thief, as mysterious as it may be.
Thank you.
Oh, that's so cool, man. Golly. And so you've been able to do that during all of the last few months.
Yeah, in lieu of touring, because all of our tours were canceled. And so we pivoted and just spent some time making new music together, which was really nice to have the opportunity to just create something new, because we've been touring so much over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably pretty weird for you, I know it is for me, but to be off the road, right, after so long being on the road.
Yeah, it was definitely a shift. But I'm really grateful, though. In so many ways, I've been able to develop new rituals and just practices of self-care. I've been practicing guitar for the first time since I was in school, like really practicing guitar, which has been so much fun. And I've been surfing. Since I moved to California, I've been spending almost every day in the ocean learning to surf. And so deepening that practice during this quarantine has been really valuable, and I'm going to miss it to a certain degree.
And why are you planning on leaving? Oh, when you eventually go...
The quarantine. I'm going to miss the lock. All this time to myself.
And you went to school. You went to like a real school for music, right? You went to Berkeley, right?
Yeah, I went to Berkeley.
And so you at one point were like really studying your instrument. But since then, it's just been like a tool of the trade.
Yeah, since I left Berkeley, I've just been playing shows and recording and, you know, touring constantly. So I've been developing my relationship with the guitar and with my voice every day since I left school, but I haven't spent much time like really developing new methods and diving into, you know, pushing my limits on the guitar. And so that's been really fun.
Dude, that's exciting. God, I can't wait to hear the new stuff.
Sure.
So for you to have wound up at Berkeley, you must have already been something of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just assuming you must have been something of a prodigy by your late teens. So you must have started pretty early. Was music something you always knew you wanted to do? Was there like an epiphany moment that you remember where you realized music was going to be your life?
Yeah, well, my first epiphany was, I think I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I became completely obsessed with Raffi, the children's musician Raffi. And I had this VHS of a live concert of his that I would watch every single day after school and just like play the broom. And then my dad like gave me his old Yamaha, or my mom gave me her old Yamaha. And I would just strum along and like open strings, you know. And yeah, he was who really opened my mind to like the power of music, I think. And just like the freedom that he instilled in children and parents alike, you know, like he just really brought people together in such a powerful way. That was the first one. And then, yeah, I got a Squire Strat and just like became obsessed with the guitar as a kid. And then I kind of fell off the bandwagon a bit in junior high. And then when I was 16, I got a job at this Mexican restaurant in Wimberley, Texas, where I grew up. And the bartender, his name is Brandon Gist. He was this like really kick-ass blues guitar player. Like just Ice House blues guitar player. And he grew up in Memphis, and he somehow found out that I played the guitar, and he took me under his wing, and we would just like hang out at his little shack behind his house every day after work and play guitar. And he taught me to play the shuffle, and like we would just both plug into his old twin reverb and rip it up, you know. And he gave me my first shows around the hill country and ice houses and stuff. So that's when I really fell in love with the guitar again. And yeah.
How old was that when you were with him?
16 years old.
So yeah, okay, so it was later in the...
And he was so gracious, you know, to just like open his world to me. And he had all these wild players in Wimberley, these old, you know, blues players, drummers and bassists around, kicking around, all these like old construction workers and stuff who just played their ass off. And so he let me just kind of sit in the back and chunk away on rhythm guitar. And so yeah, I think that really inspired me, just being able to see how music could move people, and like often just playing the ice houses around Wimberley and seeing people dance and fall in love to the music got me.
God, it's funny. That's something that comes up, especially during conversations I have with musicians. But I guess it transcends over into other disciplines. But it's that, it's the collaborative thing, right? I mean, music is essentially like, it's just, it's all collaboration. We're all working together.
Either
on a stage or in a studio or just in general, you know, like you were talking about Brandon helping you get your first gigs. I mean, we're all like lifting each other up. How beautiful.
Yeah, it is. And then that was even more developed when, I think when I was maybe 17, a friend of mine brought me out to the Curvo Folk Festival.
Yeah.
In Curvo, Texas, in Hill Country, which is, for those of you who don't know what the Curvo Folk Festival is, it's this, really it's a songwriting festival that's been happening in the Hill Country outside of Austin for the last, since 1972. And it's this, just this gathering of songwriters from around the world on this big ranch. And everyone sits around campfires until the sunrise, from like sunset to sunrise every night for 18 days, and shares their songs and their stories and develops these beautiful friendships through song. And yeah, when I first saw that at 17 years old, it really, again, like blew my mind in regards to collaboration, to like the living library of people's experiences and song, you know, through song.
Boy, it's funny to hear you describe that and to think about that as opposed to the sort of virtual world that we all live in now. And I'm not complaining. Like, this is where we're at. Like, I love that I can talk to you from the opposite end of the country. And it's as if we're just in the same room in a way. But boy, that live in person thing. I remember hearing Michelle Schacht's Campfire tapes in the '80s, where she was sort of discovered at Kerrville.
Yeah,
and they released, just someone made a field recording of her next to the campfire at Kerrville, and that is still my favorite thing that she ever made. It was such a evocative moment. I love that you got to be there as a kid.
Yeah, I was so lucky to be, and I've been there almost every year since then. I try to go for all 18 days when I can. And it's such an incredible living library of people. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because it really does. To hear you talk about the living library of it, it's like it harkens back to the beginning of music anyway. Like, that was what started. Like, this was all some continuation of the spoken, the oral history. Like, you know, the people use, like, my band Old 97s is named after the wreck of the Old 97, which is a song whose intent was to tell a story that would have been like a New York Times article now, or whatever, or not. No, I mean, that's even old-timey reference, you know, a newspaper article, that modern thing.
Nice. I didn't know that about your band name. That's beautiful.
Yeah, the wreck of the Old 97. But right, that was back then. If you wanted to hear the story of like a tragedy or, you know, it was, a lot of times it would have been a song telling you that story.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And it's a gift to be in a place like that where people are sharing just for the sake of that understanding and for that collective experience. And, you know, the songs that are being sung, I guess sometimes people are recording at campfires. In the instance of Michelle Schacht, but for the most part, there's just this ephemerality to it, where you're just sharing a song and you're only sharing it with five or six people around that fire. But some of the most magical moments of my life have been hearing songs around those fires. You know,
and boy, that makes it almost even more valuable because of the ephemerality, the ephemeral nature.
Have you ever been to Kerrville?
No, as you're talking about it, I'm realizing, you know, I grew up in Dallas, and we went to Austin all the time. And I was at South By every stupid year of my life. But in a way, South By is like the opposite of Kerrville. Like, right? Everybody's like, oh, try to get signed. Yeah. You know, in Kerrville, it's like, I'm going to sit around a campfire and blow your mind with this new song. So for you, in those late teenage years, were you already writing songs?
Well, in my teenage years, I was more focused on the guitar, first with Brandon. And then around 17 years old, I moved to this charter high school in Wimberley called Catherine and Porter, which is this incredible refuge for all the rejects and the dropouts and the goths and the wild and weird kids who like couldn't hack it in all the public schools in Hays County. They would all get funneled into this charter high school called Catherine and Porter, which was built out of this old furniture warehouse and started by this woman, Yana Bland, who is also like the princess of Malta. And she just pulled together this amazing collection of teachers, many of which weren't even necessarily certified. They were just these, you know, really strong characters and artists and writers. And And it was kind of an arts-based high school and perfectly rough around the edges. And how did I get off on that tangent?
Oh, you were writing songs.
That's right. So my first year at Catherine Ann Porter, I was introduced to this guitar player named Django Porter, who was teaching guitar there. And he was the son of Price Porter, who was an old lap steel player who played with Willie and Merle Haggard and Freddie Powers and those folks. And he named his son Django after Django Reinhardt. And serendipitously, Django developed this incredible relationship with Manouche Jazz and, you know, the music of Django Reinhardt from France. And so he then took me under his wing and I became kind of a protege to Django. And he started me by just playing that pomp rhythm on the guitar, that like four on the floor, you know, Selmer rhythm. And he took me all over the hill country playing dances and Western swing gigs and introduced me to Slim Ritchie, who was this old Western swing player, which just completely opened up my world to like that whole Bob Wills camp. And long story short, that was really my relationship with music as a teenager, was through the guitar and like this world of dances. And then when I first got to Kerrville, that was kind of my gateway into song, because I wasn't yet writing songs, but I could play the guitar and I was starting to fool around with melody and, you know, with lead and accompaniment. And I had been really playing rhythm guitar for both of the, for Django and for Brandon. And that was my bread and butter. And so I would just, at the first few years at Kerrville, move around to all the campfires and just kind of sit at the corner and play along. And people started welcoming me into their song circles kind of as like the, you know, the guitarist kid. Hold on, my phone's ringing through my computer. Let me just set it down.
Very modern problems. If you've just joined us, we're interviewing Buck Meek from his deck in Topanga Canyon.
All right. So yeah, that was kind of my gateway into these song circles. And then through that, I developed kind of the bones of my relationship with song itself and started to understand song form and the arc of narrative, but more like from an instrumental place. And then slowly started writing songs on my own, kind of in between the cracks, maybe around 17.
How were those earliest songs? I wonder, because I started young too, and I know I look back on those earliest songs and I'm just like, oh my God, it took me 100 songs before I wrote one that I thought was good.
For sure.
Were you like that, or were you more like Neil Young, where at 17 you're like writing Sugar Mountain or whatever?
Oh no, I'm sure they were terrible. I think my first song was called, or like one of my first songs was like, Love is Blind But I Can See, or something like that, you know. They were all coming from a need to communicate something to like a girl, or, you know, but and I'm sure they were so valuable at the time, but unfortunately I didn't record many of them and I've forgotten them. So
again, the ephemeral nature, right? They had value at the time.
Yeah.
And they were valuable to you, right? Because you had to write through them to get to the songs that were better and better and better.
Exactly. And I think I knew that in the process. I think just from being at Kerrville and being around all these old timers in the hill country, I had a pretty high, pretty high ceiling. I got pretty high bar. I guess I knew what a good song was just from like being in such close proximity with all these old timers. And also in Wimberley, there was so many old outlaw riders like Ray Wiley Hubbard and Butch Hancock from the Flatlanders. And a lot of those folks were constantly passing through. And so I was somewhat intimidated to a certain degree and like to even like exist within that realm at all, you know. And I think I threw away my first 100 songs.
So I think before we started, I was getting you to tell me a little bit about sort of how you're dealing with the pandemic. And you talked about sort of self-care and the surfing that you're doing. And it seems like that's something that you're aware of, you think about. I just wonder about, I guess specifically right now, because it's just such a weird time, but in general, like, how do you deal with the sort of internally generated obstacles that artists typically run up against? I mean, I'm assuming that you have some self-doubt. I don't know how it manifests itself for you, but how do you deal with it?
Well, I think the most reliable method that I've found to approach that challenge is to try to create limitations in whatever my process is, specifically to initiate the instinct, to initiate my instinct, to like reveal my my first response to a stimulus or to a thought or to a feeling or to a melody, etc., you know, whatever the stimulus may be, to try to just honor that first impulse and to not hide it or run, or, you know, and to basically to trust it and to follow that and see where it goes without trying to control it. And there's a balance, because there's a certain amount of consciousness that's required for that process. As you know, even as simply as just holding a pencil and like going through the motions of documenting something, which can be so vulnerable. But yeah, that's my core focus, I suppose, in removing those obstacles. And in the recording process, for instance, like with this new solo record that is coming out in July, Two Saviors, my friend Andrew Soller, who produced the record, and I, we wanted to try to remove as much of the fear and reflection from the process as possible. And so we chose to make the record in just a week, and we worked on an 8-track tape machine with just a bunch of old EV, like Electro Voice dynamic microphones, in one room in an old house in New Orleans. And he would have us wake up and play the songs just once through in the morning, maybe twice if we messed something up real bad. But like, for the most part, we just got one shot at each tune, and we'd play the album down, and then we'd take like a 7 or 8 hour break, siesta, and read our book and wander through New Orleans. And then we'd come back, have dinner, and then play another set in the evening, and just for 7 days. And he didn't let us wear headphones, or he wouldn't let us hear anything back throughout the whole process. So we couldn't hear back takes. There was no comping or, you know, and everything was live, at least in that first process. And then on the sixth or seventh day, Andrew had taken notes, and he had kind of, you know, he had taken notes on the takes he felt like were the most revealing. And then we quickly picked takes and then quickly moved through the overdub process, which is just a, you know, maybe a harmony here and there, but all of that just to remove the obstacle of self-reflection and try to just instigate the instincts and adrenaline, you know.
God, that is brilliant. I mean, I've heard of different, I've even messed around with different things like that, where the emphasis is on live recording, and it takes away some of the paralysis of choice, and it's more about the feeling of the performance. But to hear that description of a set in the morning, one time through each song, a set in the evening, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that was Andrew Sarlo's idea. And I think just with the philosophy that so often in, at least in my experience and in Andrew Sarlo's experience of making records, you know, you'll spend all day working on a song, and you'll go through 10 takes of something, and then inevitably you end up choosing the first take or second take, you know, because even if it's messy, it holds something that's just so vital often, you know. And so I think the idea was to try to stimulate that essence of a first take. But, you know, at the same time, like collecting is, you know, 14 versions of a song, while they all kind of held that energy of a first take. That was the idea.
Boy, I love it. And it's in a way, it's such a rejection of, you know, what technology makes possible, where you can just pour over every note and make it line up to a click so perfectly.
For sure. Which is also a totally valid process. And like, there's so many people that have found empowerment through that process, you know. But I'm such a, I have the tendency to be such a perfectionist if I allow myself the facility to be. And so this was a really valuable exercise for me to like, to limit that. And yeah. And then of course it was alchemized by Andrew Sarlo's facility. You know, he's such a brilliant engineer, and he had a lot. I mean, he was putting so much thought and intention into the sounds, and of course there was a lot of bleed, but it was very intentional, and he was slamming it to tape, so it was really hot, and that was intentional, and like he was making the most of the sonic environment. And we did experiment quite a bit with the location. We moved around the house for the first few days and tried to find the rooms that resonated the best. And so it was kind of this alchemy between the band's just complete unhinged flying off the seat of our pants reactions with Andrew Sarlo's like very intentional capture, you know.
I wonder, and this is just me wondering, was the morning or the evening in general, which takes were the ones that you kept?
Some of the tunes worked in the morning and some of the tunes worked in the night. It kind of depended on the song. Yeah, like the song Pocket Knife, I think, came from the morning. And we actually did two versions of a song on the record called Two Moons. And one is from the evening and one is from the morning. So you can hear the difference, actually.
That's awesome. Well, God, I think that that's such a useful answer in terms of like, how do you deal with the internally generated obstacles and the self-doubt and the things that tend to shut down our creative selves. For you to say that you really focus on your listening to your instincts. I mean, I'm not sure that's exactly how you said it, but that's sort of, that is what makes us artists, right?
Yeah.
You know, because we're constantly making choices. You have any word in the world, what word are you going to sing next? You have all the notes and all the notes between notes. Where are you going to go? It's always the choices, right? And you could get stopped down by them, or you can just keep going.
Yeah, and just trust. I think trust is such a huge part of it. And I've been trying to practice, like when I sit down to write a song, just starting by by mumbling nonsense at first, just letting my mouth create sounds that feel good to just roll around in my cheeks, you know, and like marbles almost, and to, you know, to just follow that thread and until something works, until something feels good, and then kind of observe what those sounds phonetically represent as far as the English language, and then slowly deciphering it into English, at least at the beginning, and then from there kind of change direction and put more intention, like conscious intention, into developing a narrative from that. But like, I love that phenomenon of like the seed emerging from something more subconscious.
Yeah. I mean, I feel it for me, certainly that's the best place of, you know, people say, well, what do you want this song to be about? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever it wants to be about.
Yeah. That's the wild. Yeah. That's it. Discovery is what it's all about.
So you've been doing this for a long time. I mean, even though you're still young, I wonder if you look back, if you were to meet a 21-year-old version of Buck Meek, but working now in today's world, what advice might you give yourself?
That's a good question. Hopefully you can edit out dead space while I think.
No, I love it. Actually, I really enjoy watching you think through. It's. I appreciate you giving a thoughtful answer.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Was it? Somebody said.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, sorry. Somebody said, I would tell myself, don't smoke cigarettes.
Oh, yeah.
Suzanne Santo said, maybe chill out on the tattoos.
Nice. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that I would tell myself to trust myself and to trust my impulses, you know, for instance, at least in the musical context, because of course, as a human being and as a friend and as a partner and as a social being, you have to guide yourself appropriately, of course, but within the musical landscape, there's absolutely no rules, you know? And so I think I would tell myself to just trust my impulses and follow them, because you just have no idea where they will lead. And even if like at first, if something feels contrived or if it appears to be derivative of some other artist, which of course may
shut you down,
bring judgment, or you know, whatever, just trust it, because you have no idea where it will lead, and it might bring you to somewhere that's truly original, or you know, completely, it probably will bring you to somewhere that's completely unique, and you're just processing and alchemizing different elements within your psyche and your voice. And so try not to be so critical in the process and just see where it goes.
It's funny, I sense a thread through so many of your answers that has to do with self-kindness, which I really appreciate that. I feel like that's such a good message, especially right now.
It is. And it's so hard as an artist. That's one of the biggest challenges because, it's so vulnerable to express yourself.
Yeah. It's funny, earlier you described just putting a pencil to a paper as being an incredibly vulnerable act. And I think that's true. And it's important to recognize it because people feel like they're the only one that ever gets shut down by the vulnerability implicit in that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so hard to, it's so easy to shut down and to stop out of fear as a method of like self-protection. But if you can just trust that it's really like the process will guide you through to, just keep moving, If you can just keep moving, you'll get somewhere.
That reminds me, there's the new Maggie Smith book. Actually, I have it right here called Keep Moving.
Oh, wow. Crazy. Yeah,
it's so beautiful. But that's just, it's such a great message, right? Because it's so easy to stop and convince yourself that that's the right move. And it's almost never the right move, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with like writing a terrible song because it's gonna be a stepping stone to something else.
I love that.
And it's also so subjective too. Like that, all that judgment is just completely subjective, and it's a construct. Emotion is the most important, I think. Yeah,
it's like stories we tell ourselves, and so often those stories are from dark parts of ourselves that are not doing us any favors. Maybe.
Yeah, or stories that we're projecting onto others or telling each other. Yeah.
Oh, man. I got to say, I wish right now that I was in Topanga Canyon with you right now. The light looks so beautiful. And
oh, man.
I really enjoyed getting to talk with you. And
I wish you were here. We could go walk through the state park and, grab some white sage. And...
oh, man. Well, thank you so much. This is so cool. Congrats on the new solo record. I can't wait to hear whatever the mysterious Big Thief is that's going to be announced someday soon. This is great.
Thank you so much for asking such thoughtful questions and setting aside the time. I really appreciate it. I'm a huge fan.
Thanks. I think people are going to get so much out of this, and it's so cool to speak with a fellow Texan, and I hope we get to share a bill or at least a dressing room someday soon.
Yeah, me too. I'm sure we will.
I hope so. Take care, man.
All right, brother. Peace.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!